30,000 American GIs were killed or wounded in the longest battle ever fought by the United States Army. A battle that has been ignored for more than 40 years. A battle that should have never been fought. From September 1944 to February 1945, 8 United States infantry and 2 United States armored divisions were thrown into the green hell of Hurtgen Forest. 50 square miles of thick, rugged, hilly woods on the Belgian-German border, full of German soldiers in a deadly network of concrete bunkers. The butcher's bill was high. Casualty rates ran to 50% and more for most rifle companies. In the dense forests of fir trees with such limited visibility, death could come from any direction, including from above, where mortar shells exploded in the treetops and rained down red-hot, razor-sharp shrapnel. The GIs called it the Death Factory. To be there was to be in constant terror. Entire battalions broke down, combat fatigue disabled thousands, and the constant exposure to rain, snow, coal, and endless mud disabled thousands more. The high command from the relative comfort and security of headquarters miles away from the forest refused to admit that there had been a mistake. Careers were at stake, the pride of the army. So more troops were shoveled in and the slaughter continued to capture an objective that had long since lost in a real purpose. Saturday, December the 16th, 1944. Later, the top brass claimed that they had known of some degree what was to come that dawn. Reports were fudged, files disappeared, and conversation was doctored to show that the generals really had taken the threat of a German counterattack on the Western Front that December very seriously. None of them ever admitted in their various memoirs that they had been taken completely, totally by surprise. In fact, on that gray, gloomy morning when the world fell apart over 40 years ago, the top brass played, while hundreds, perhaps thousands, of British, French, Canadian, and American soldiers fought and died that Saturday, the generals amused themselves. After all, it was Saturday, and the rank had its privileges. The day before, Hodges at Spa had received some visiting firemen, professional baseball players such as Bucky Walters and Dutch Leonard, Mailot, and the like. This morning, still heavy with a cold, Hodges received yet more visitors, fellow generals Bradley and Pete Quasata of the Army Air Corps. They were fitted there for shotguns to be custom made by the Belgian gunmaker at Liège. That done, General Bradley, who couldn't fly to Paris because of bad weather, set out in his sedan for the French capital, where he would see Eisenhower in the afternoon. First, he had lunch at the Ritz, where champagne flowed and there were beaucoups of celebrities. It was rich living for a man who had been an obscure light colonel back in 1941. As the supreme commander that fatal morning, he was throwing a champagne reception for two of his staff. About 10 o'clock, Eisenhower and most of his immediate staff went across to the Louis XIV Chapel at Versailles to see the first marriage solemnized there in nearly 200 years. The happy couple consists of his valet and ex-bellhop, Mickey McKee, and a diminutive, bespectacled wax sergeant, Pearlie Hargrave. Ike was convinced that McKee brought him good luck, and the man also wrote a weekly report back to Mamie on his boss's activities. Of course, he didn't tell her everything his boss did. Ike genuinely liked the two of them. It was a democratic thing to do. The important man who commanded the destinies of millions of men and women attending the wedding of two humble NCOs. Besides, it made for good public relations. Later, after the reception with the drinks provided by the Supreme Commander, the champagne flowed. I kissed the bride and hardly shook the hand of his good luck charm, and the champagne flowed even more. Indeed, as Kay Summerville would record one day later, when her lover's division were reeling back in scared confusion all along the front line, half the headquarters was soggy with the silence of plain, unadulterated, ordinary hangovers. At the reception, Eisenhower was buttonholed by an old crony, hard-drinking, skirt-chasing General Everett Hughes. Hughes wasn't there for Pearlie and Mickey. He was there to congratulate Ike. He told the latter happily, "I couldn't bear the idea of having gotten drunk when you received the 4th star and not having a drink when you got your 5th. The Supreme Commander gave him the benefit of that air-to-air smile, which had become familiar to cinema audiences all over the Western world. He invited Hughes for dinner that night. Bradley was coming this afternoon to have a chat about the shortage of riflemen at the front. That night there had been a comfy all-male dinner and to shoot the breeze just like in the good old days before the war. Hughes said he would be there. He'd bring a bottle of Highland Piper Scotch, and in Hughes' reddened eyes there could be no deeper mark of respect than that. In a headquarters abashed with French champagne, captured German schnapps, and cognac, there was always a chronic shortage of good Scotch whiskey. Ike told Hughes that someone had presented him with a bushel of oysters, which he adored. His darkies, as he called his black mess servants, were already preparing oysters on the half shell to be followed by oyster stew with fried oysters, concluding the festive pre-Christmas meal. Hughes said he wouldn't miss it for the world. It would be a swell way to celebrate Ike's 5th star. That was only one problem, however. The Supreme Commander pondered how he was going to fit those 5 stars on his jacket. Perhaps he could find someone to embroider them on for him. Early that morning, the forward observer of the 903 Field Artillery Battalion supporting the infantry of the 78th Division had spotted a flicker of movement in the pre-dawn darkness. Instantly, he whispered into the field telephone, "Counterattack, counterattack forming." Within minutes, as the Furwood staff worked out the positions, the cannoneers were at work on their howitzers, sighting and loading, trundling up more shells, sweating in spite of the freezing cold. The order went out to all division artillery, whole battalions. All battalions were to fire exactly the same time, and not one volley, but 5 in rapid succession. The battery executive stood by, ready for the word. Then it came over the phone, "Fire." Scores of lanyards were pulled, the earth shook, the guns thundered into action with an air-splitting roar. Night turned to day. In violent bursts of scarlet, a furious barrage descended upon the advancing Germans. The very ground seemed to erupt all about them, as if there had been an earthquake. Once, twice, 3 times, in the forward position, the shocked infantry clutched for support as the Germans screamed with terror and pain. Minutes later, they broke, running back the way they had come in disorganized, terrified 2s and 3s. Behind them, they left the snow littered with their dead. That was a half an hour before dawn. By mid-morning, the Germans were attacked in full strength, backed up with the self-propelled guns. The 10th Panther Division, which had been commanded by the Desert Fox Rommel himself, swept all before it, heading straight for the newly captured Kesnick. The CO of the 2nd Battalion, who was left in his shattered battalion, surrendered and was whipped off into the bag. Kesnick was recaptured and the surviving defenders, a captain and 56 men, were taken prisoner. Herd of the 3rd Battalion of the 309 Regiment and a task force of the 310th 2nd Battalion were flung into the counterattack. Clerks, drivers who had lost their vehicles, cooks, heavy weapon men, anyone could hold on to an M1 was formed into a task force that drove into Keswick that grim Saturday before the Germans in an overwhelming strength flung them out again. The Germans seemed to be attacking everywhere. What was going on? A few miles away, what was left of the 2nd Ranger Battalion had been resting for 6 days. Nerves were still taut from the terrible beating that the battalion had taken on Castle Hill, and the survivors were hoping desperately that they would be sent home. Just as the survivors of the shattered 1st and 3rd Battalions had been the slaughter of bloody Anzio. But that wasn't to be. At mid-morning on Saturday, the 2nd Rangers were alerted for immediate move. The greenhorns of the 7th to 8th were crying out for help. As the battalion history of the 2nd Rangers recorded, every available soldier had to be thrown into battle. The Germans had to be stopped if it took every rifleman, cook, clerk in the theater. So once again, the handful of Rangers were loaded into freezing open trucks and sit out for the front as flares sailed in the sky. The guns rumbled, and overhead V1 buzz bombs, the Rangers called them, putted and putted, sounded like two-stroke motorbikes carrying their one-ton loads of high explosive towards the Liège and Antwerp. As the convoy rolled toward the grim sounds of battle, the Rangers prayed that it wasn't going to be another Castle Hill. They couldn't take that kind of slaughter again. Not yet, anyway. But as battalion history calls, it started out through the same way that Bernstein and the Hill 400 had started. The immediate delays, the wind and the cold, the lying along the side of the road and waiting for what they knew. Finally, they reached their destination, the outskirts of a village called Semmerath, next to the German counterattack. Here they were met by an obviously very frightened officer from the 7th to 8th, who actually whispered their instructions to them as if the Germans were just around the corner. Be careful, challenge everybody. Jerry paratroopers have been dropping like flies. Don't make any noise. The Germans are only 300 yards away, and Jerry paratroopers are dropping like flies. Further north, the men of the 9th and 83rd Division were also posed the same question, and they were struck by the most unremitting and consecrated artillery barrage of the whole campaign. Where, in God's name, had the Krauts gotten all the strength from? It was no different at Heartbreak Crossroads, just south of the 78th, where the 78th was battling. The 2nd Armored Infantry Division had been attacking through the Green 99th Division Infantry, attempting to take the crossroads. There, the 2nd had launched their attack on the 13th, the man burdened with enough rations, ammunition, and anti-tank mines to last 24 hours. Each are drenched, exhausted from the approach march, and frozen. They all grouped around the road junction with 10 bunkers protected by rows of barbed wire. Things started to move in the Americans' favor. A patrol found a gap in the wire. From now on this Saturday, December the 16th, terrible things started to happen to the Green 99th Division through which the 2nd was attacking. Captain Charles McDonald, then a 22-year-old company commander with the 2nd Infantry, later recalled watching as the battered remnants of the battalion from the 99th Division, 200 men out of the original 900, came streaming through its own lines. Two of them volunteered to stay and fight with his company, but the rest kept on going through the trees to the rear. Their fear was overwhelming. I lay flat on my back, Donald said. In the slit trench, the platoon phone in one ear, receive a battalion radio in the other. The chill from the frozen earth seeped through my clothes and I shivered but I was surprised at my own calmness. Surely this was one of the most serious situations at which I had ever found myself. Nothing but time, time born of bodies of dead men. And that's the way it was on December the 16th, 1944. A lot of Americans must have felt a little like Mr. McDonald. His clothes were drenched, perspiration covered his body, his mouth was dry. The Germans were launching a mighty counterattack. Soon they would have 600,000 men in the field, sweeping all before them, shattering whole American divisions. After the terrible blood-slogging match in the Hurtgen Forest, 4 long months of it, all that pain and sacrifice, the tremendous losses, how could the Germans still execute a tact of such magnitude?
This is an editor's note. End of tape A, side 1. The interview continues on tape A, side 2.
It was good for us. I hurt. I'd rather go out in a bus. I hurt. We hiked and hiked till our feet were sore. We didn't know what we were marching for. We walked 10 miles and they said more. I hurt. We sang some songs, but it didn't help. I hurt. Our barking dogs began to yelp. I hurt. The medics tried their best to cure with bandages they said were pure. But one thing that I knew for sure, I hurt. The road beneath our feet was rough. I hurt. It really made the going tough. I hurt. We always had our 10-minute breaks, but my body was full of pains and aches. I was tired. For goodness sake, I hurt. We thought the trip would never end. I hurt. The shoes we wore will have to mend. I hurt. I don't know if I ever will be fit to climb another hill. The hike is over now, but still, I hurt. Jackson had his acorns and Grant his precious rye. Teddy had his poison beef, worse you couldn't buy. The doughboy had his hardtack without this army jam. All armies on their stomach move, and this one moves on Spam. For breakfast they will fry it, for supper it is baked. For dinner, what a lovely dish, they had it patty cake. Next morning it's with flapjacks, or maybe powdered eggs. Where in the hell they get it all, they must order it by kegs. Surely for the evening meal they'll cook up something new, but those cooks seem uncanny, for now it's in the stew. And thus this tireless cycle goes, it never seems to cease. Spam in the stew, and spam in the pie, and spam in boiling grease. We had it with salad, with cabbage for corned beef. We had it as an entree and for our appetite. We had it with spaghetti, with chili, and with rice. I remember such a happy day, we only had it twice. Back home there is an angel whose name I'm going to change. I'll buy that girl a lovely home with just the finest range. But marital bliss is sure to cease the day I ask for ham. And found my eggs are looking from a slice of army spam.
All began when an obscure German corporal, the son of an Austrian custom official, who was blinded by mustard gas in a British attack. And as he lay in the hospital, he started to plan. His patriotic anger fused with his envy of the rich, the hatred of the Jews, and shining before him he saw his duty to save Germany, to avenge her wrongs and lead the master race to its long decreed destiny. In 1936 he moved into Rhineland. In 1938 he took Austria. In 1939 he moved into Czechoslovakia, then Poland, then France, Belgium, and on to Russia. The United States joined England on August the 12th, 1941, to defeat Germany. And that's where I came in. They knew they couldn't do it without me. I was drafted by my friends and neighbors, and I received a card in the mail on November the 3rd, 1942, signed by Dr. John B. Ray, saying you are hereby classified as 1A. Just 11 days later, I received another card saying that I was to report to Camp Cross, South Carolina. I was appointed a leader of a contingent of selected men from our local board to go by bus to Camp Croft. And on the morning I left for Camp Croft, my mother shed tears. I wasn't sure whether she was shedding tears for me or whether she was shedding tears that our church was on fire. The reason for my being selected a leader, Dr. Ray brought me into the world, so he wanted me to go out leading. So I was classified on the 3rd, and on the 27th, I was a soldier. From Camp Croft, I was sent to Camp Van Dorn, Mississippi, where I was to be a part of a brand new division called the 99th, led by General Walter E. Lauer. The 99th Division was later called the Checkerboard Division. My company commander was Captain Charles Bergen of Drexel, North Carolina. My top kick was a Greek from California named George Malakas. Our camp was near Natchez, Mississippi, not too far from Baton Rouge, Louisiana. I was homesick, scared, and unhappy. For over a year, I was to learn to shoot an M1, a BAR, and crawl under machine gun fire, climb ropes, walk mile after mile and run the same distance, do close order drill, salute and say sir to every shaved tail I met. I peeled potatoes and cleaned latrines and picked up cigarette butts, polished shoes, and I pitched tents in woods filled with ticks, chiggers, and snakes. That's not all. When I left Camp Van Dorn, Mississippi, I was sent to Camp Maxey, Texas, to do the same thing all over again. Once when we were on maneuvers in Texas, and I was sent out with a patrol of men to find the enemy, and as we were going down a country road, we noticed that a large cable of wires were in the side ditch. We thought it must be the enemy, so we cut it in shreds. The next day, orders came down from headquarters saying maneuvers had been called off because someone had cut all communication lines. I came in one night off pass, and someone had tied a live coral snake on the board where we had to sign in. Finally, they decided they couldn't win the war without the 99th Division, so we packed up and slipped through the northern part of the United States and into Canada. That was so the Germans would know we were coming. We left Boston on the Marine Devil, a converted tanker. I was in a large convoy, the biggest ever to leave the States. We had several aircraft carriers, and we had several sub-alerts. I stayed seasick the whole way over. I would start down to ship's mess, and that's a good word for it, when someone behind me would throw up, and I would never make it. I would go back to my bunk, and I ate crackers and chocolate and prayed to die. I was a tech sergeant in a rifle company, Company I of the 395th Infantry, or the 3rd Battalion of the 99th Division. I was a platoon leader with a platoon headquarters with a second lieutenant, three squads with a sergeant and 10 men in each squad. All in all, we had 43 men. Of that number, 32 would be killed, wounded, taken prisoner, or cracked up. First, let me tell you something straight. I am not proud,
I don't think I'm smart, and I certainly don't want you to think that I'm bragging. What I did because I had to, not because I loved it. I was just one of the poor souls that happened to be born at the wrong time. And I just hope that I can pass along to you what war is really like. It's hell, no matter how you look at it. I just hope and pray that it may never happen to you or your children. Our division landed from England at Le Havre, France. When we arrived in port, there were ships sunk all over the harbor, and we could see only the masts sticking up. Our division was the first to cross the Rhine River, the first to cross the bridge at Remagen before it was blown. Our division captured the German general with orders for Hitler's all-out offensive, later to be called the Breakthrough or the Battle of the Bulge, which was the turning point of the war, when over 76,000 Americans would be killed, wounded, or taken prisoner. Our outfit was dug in at Monchau in the Ardennes Forest. Some of us were staying in houses, while others were in foxholes out on the front line. We could see Germans dug in across the hillside. We had stuffed bed sheets and blankets in the top of the chimneys on the roof so that the smoke would not be seen by artillery planes. The smoke went out into the upstairs room. We stayed in a basement. One night we were all seated around the phones in the basement when someone pulled the phones from the table. Our lieutenant stuck his machine gun out the window and started shooting. The next day we had steak. He had killed a cow. One of our guys made pancakes, and he couldn't read German, and what he thought was flour was plaster of Paris. We were having it pretty good then. We had plenty to eat. We would take pot shots at the Germans across the hill, and we'd shoot at Bed Check Charlie as he flew over our lines at night, checking for lights so he could direct artillery in. The time was 5 a.m. The date was December the 16th, 1944. All at once they hit us from the sky, paratroopers, artillery fire, burp guns, screaming memes, tanks through our lines. Like 100 freight trains, they hit us. Our house was hit. We were breaking, shooting at everything that moved. Our CO called for artillery on our own lines. Dead Germans were stacked like cordwood. I ran over to a foxhole to pull a guy out, and his arm came off in my hand. I saw the medics bring my buddies by. I drove a jeep through snow to pick up a lieutenant that had been hit and died from shock. I loaded on three other guys who had been killed. Our planes were unable to fly because of the heavy overcast. 4 days later, the sky cleared, and over 5,000 planes came over our lines. They bombed the Germans on the highway. They machine gunned them on the run. I've never seen a more beautiful sight than all those planes. We won that battle. 19,000 Germans were dead, 100,000 wounded. We went out on patrol one night. We wore sheets so we would blend in with the snow. We went behind German lines and found a pillbox. We could hear the Germans talking, so we tossed a hand grenade down the chimney. They ran out and we killed two and captured six. We had an old guy from Kentucky named Huff. His parents were bootleggers, and he could shoot a rifle like nobody. A German officer was captured, and he told our CO that he had 10 men shot in the head by a sniper. We were finally relieved by another outfit just arrived from the States, and I was left behind to show them the positions. The first night, they killed two of their own men on guard duty. The next day, I left and started down the highway looking for my outfit. We went 2 months without taking a bath. It was too cold. We were ordered to take a city about the size of Greensboro near Bergheim, and we really had a ball in that town. The Germans were caught off guard. We had them before they knew we were there.
We took half tracks in jeeps and command cars and rode through the city shooting the store windows out and taking mannequins from the store windows and sitting them in the back seat of the jeeps. We did lose a few men from sniper fire. The Germans lined about 150 Americans up in the snow and rode by in tanks and shot them down. Several played dead. After the Germans left, they joined our outfit. From then on, they never took a prisoner. Every time they started back with a prisoner, they shot him. The SS troops were the meanest. We very seldom took an SS a prisoner. The saddest day was to follow when so many died for no reason. We were in a large barn outside a small village getting ready to make an attack. One of our guys was loading a bazooka to let the shell go and hit the floor. It went off and blew his legs off, killed a lieutenant and six others. A captain and lieutenant were wounded along with 20 others. The Germans heard the noise and started throwing artillery. I guess they thought they'd killed us all, so they stopped. Sergeant Malakas and myself was under a large horse that saved us. One of my guys said he had had enough, and so he shot his toe off and told the CO he was loading his rifle. We were called offline one day to go back to Cologne to parade for General Eisenhower, Montgomery, and Hodges. We were fed fried chicken. The newsreel cameras didn't take our picture because we looked so pitiful. When we were getting ready to cross the Rhine, the Germans threw in artillery shells with propaganda leaflets telling us that our wives were back home having a good time and we should surrender. They said that there would not be a live American on that side of the Rhine in 24 hours. I couldn't swim, so I'd pick myself a place to run across. We had to cross a large moat to reach a small village, and the Germans had machine guns set up to fire across the top of the water. As I said, I couldn't swim, and my guide told me to catch the end of his rifle, and he pulled me across. If you don't believe it, that's hard to do. We took the town so fast that the Germans were still talking on phones when we walked in on them. We took one town that had been a large liquor distillery. All my guys got drunk, most of them. And I told my guide, one who had pulled me across the moat, he must have played with the Minnesota Vikings. Anyway, I asked him, wouldn't he hate to die drunk? And he said, I might as soon go that way as any. And about that time, a shell came in and we dived for the side ditch. And he was hit in the leg and the medics carried him off. 3 months later, I was in the parish hospital and I saw him in a wheelchair. The first thing he said was, I nearly died drunk. I took hepatitis from eating greasy food, so I was sent back to parish. The sergeant who took my place was killed the very next day in a tank attack, and I made up my mind that I wasn't going back to the front, and I yelled every time the doctor punched my stomach, as I had hepatitis, and that was one day they checked you out. About that time Roosevelt died, Truman dropped the bomb, and it was over. I didn't see Hitler nor Berlin. I did see Churchill and General Patton. I saw the charred bodies of thousands of Jews. I would not want to go back. But I made a lot of friends whom I still hold dear, and once a year we get together for a reunion. I still receive a Christmas card from a family I stayed with in Belgium during the breakthrough. I realize that many things we did was wrong, but no one, unless you saw how mean those people were, can judge us. The little children, the old people, machine gunned and burned to death. I have no regrets, just sad memories.